Welcome to the University of the Free State Career Services podcast, where we talk to experts about the ins and outs of jobs and share tips that will give you a grip on your future career. I'm Belinda Yonica, and today in our virtual studio, I've got Professor Llewellyn Padiachi. How are you?
I am great, thanks.
Excellent. Now, Professor, you are currently a full clinical professor and the head of department of neurosurgery at the University of Pretoria. And there are so many other things, and we are definitely going to unpack that. But before we unpack that, tell me about the best day in your career. When was that and what happened?
So thanks so much for the question. You know, when I looked at that, I thought I want to make a point by answering that question. So I'm going to answer it in a sort of dual way. The best day or the best event is certainly when I look back, the International Society for Pediatric Neurosurgery awarded me something called the Anthony Raimondi Award, which is quite a prestigious thing. The meeting happened to be in Kobe in Japan at the time, and a lot of the philosophy that I'd integrated into my thought process, you know, was Japanese, and we'll unpack this potentially later as well, something called Kintsu Kuroi. So I got to give this plenary talk, speaking about the work we've done in a culture, or, you know, in a place where the culture and philosophy had influenced my thinking over many, many years. So that was serendipitous for me in many ways. And then secondly, I wanted to just say, you know, I had the privilege of hosting the World Congress of Neuroendoscopy in Cape Town in 2017. So it wasn't a day, but it was an event. And we got to showcase some of our work and, you know, interact with some of the world's leading thinkers on minimally invasive neurosurgery for brain tumors and hydrocephalus and that sort of thing. So really a combination between the two, but I think they sort of converge in a point where they both reflect an opportunity to share with some of the leading thinkers some of the world or the work that we've done.
And what does that work then entail? So let's unpack that career in neuroscience as well. What is it? How did you create that passion for that?
So specifically for me, my research and clinical pathways have been on diagnosing raised intracranial pressure non-invasively. And that's come about because I'm primarily a pediatric neurosurgeon. So I spent the bulk of my career, still most of it now, treating children with diseases of the brain and the central nervous system. And one thing that I've consistently picked up is that no matter when these kids arrive at our door, you know, it's always later than they should have been referred. So the ability to diagnose or screen for raised intracranial pressure, which is really a proxy for underlying conditions like brain tumors, hydrocephalus, infection, really almost all of the pediatric and adult, for that matter, conditions that neurosurgery or neurosurgeons treat, present with this symptom complex of raised intracranial pressure. And it's probably easier to understand if you look at diagnosing raised temperature. So if your temperature is up and you can diagnose that earlier, you know something's wrong, and you can pick up chest infection or meningitis or any sort of infection a lot earlier. So what we lack is the screening tool. And I spent a lot of the early part of my career refining, identifying, reviewing published techniques, described techniques, and we were fortunate enough to work with really the best team in the world from Trondheim through a research institute called SINTEF. And we fine-tuned algorithms, defined novel ways of improving diagnostic accuracy using ultrasound to scan the eye for a technique called, you know, measurement of the optic nerve sheath diameter. And then we sort of improved on that, and we described novel techniques relating to the cardiac pulsatility of the heart and the stiffness of the sheath. So we showed that by scanning the eye, you're actually able to pick up raised intracranial pressure earlier. So this addressed, you know, this need that we thought was really vital to diagnosing other conditions earlier. So that was the one big part. I think a lot of the research focus was there. I've also spent a lot of my time refining neurosurgical techniques for minimally invasive access to removing tumors or treating hydrocephalus, mostly endoscopy, but also other adjuncts. And that's how these sort of two things, you know, converged, because ultimately ultrasound can be used intraoperatively to guide resection of brain tumors. So it is quite a nice interplay. You know, we started working in these two fields and they came together quite nicely, to a sort of inflection point.
Professor, how did you, again, ignite that passion for neurosciences? What was your journey from student into where you are currently at? Because I can just imagine a student doing medical sciences, how do you make the decision that neurosciences is now the way to go?
So that's a really interesting question. And we've built quite a bit of research capacity recently, I'm talking about, driving neuroscience and attracting really the top students, you know, at various institutions, so UP, UCT, Oxford, and I'll tell you why those specific institutions. And when you ask me a question like that, when I was a medical student, neurosciences weren't very high up on my, you know, agenda. I then applied for an internship, as we do or as we did at the time, and I got I got an internship at Groote Schuur Hospital, Cape Town. And completely serendipitously, my first rotation was through the neurosurgery department at Groote Schuur Hospital. And, you know, it's quite intimidating as an intern. And there were three of us. And fortunately, the head of the department at the time was still one of South Africa's greatest neurosurgeons, Professor Jonathan Peter. And the department at the time was really this high-powered, consultant group. And working there was such a privilege. And part of that meant I got to spend time at Red Cross Children's Hospital with pediatric surgery. Those two rotations, defined what I was going to do. There was also the head of department at the time of pediatric surgery was a Professor Heinz Roeder. You know, was an absolute icon in the field. And he made it very clear to us that even as interns, just walking through the corridors of Red Cross was a privilege. The fact that parents had trusted the care of their children to us was an absolute privilege. And that left such an indelible mark on my thought process. You know, from there, it became a lot clearer to me that this is something that I would want to spend the rest of my career doing. And fortunately, I managed to, you know, to be able to do that. So pediatric neurosurgery is what I've spent roughly the last 20 years or so doing.
So your lecturers, mentors, were really playing a role in that, as well as you searching for that opportunity and looking for links, right?
Without a doubt. And I think we don't value enough, or we should place so much more emphasis on the role of mentorship and guidance. We've got such bright students coming through, and we need to make sure that the opportunity to guide them and nudge them and just give them that little bit of extra spark that they require, you know, to move them into the neurosciences. Well, basically, obviously, where they would like to go. But the value, or at least the appeal of the neurosciences, needs to be highlighted, particularly in a South African context. You know, I think we're at a point now, if you look at artificial intelligence and, you know, the projects that try to unpack the science and the art, as I've said many times before, of unpacking the secrets of the brain, we're really at an era now where that's at the forefront of research and medicine.
And are you currently working with AI technology, especially because you are an expert internationally recognized for that minimally invasive surgical techniques?
Sure. So to answer that question, you know, artificial intelligence recently has gotten so much traction in the media and social media particularly, that it almost appears as though it was dormant for the longest time. And that's not really the case. So I was really privileged to interact with incredibly smart engineers from Trondheim in Norway. And there were some ideas that I had, but, you know, we need to realize that research projects in the modern day, for them to advance to a point where they become useful or get taken to the next level, they need to be in the context of collaborative, multidisciplinary teams. And that is something that I think is becoming incredibly almost a fundamental tool of most of the research institutes, where they drive this multidisciplinary research approach. So we were really privileged to be part of that, where we were able to put these large volumes of data into mathematical modeling algorithms and apply artificial intelligence to refine these diagnostic techniques. So this is on a very small scale. If you look at what's being done now, where Neuralink and and specific sort of companies or drives like that are looking at interfacing pathways from the brain to treat conditions like paralysis and stroke. You know, that's really exciting to see. So attracting students to this neuroscience entity or this neuroscience domain is really something we should put a lot of focus on in the next few years.
Is it then only medical sciences students that can work in neurosciences, or which other industries can get involved?
No, not at all. I think that is such an important question and such an important point, that what people bring to the complete sort of research concert, if you like, is definitely not restricted to medical students. So in our research group, we've got BSc honors students from physiology, from psychology. You know, engineering for me brings such a vital angle to what we think. And you know, as we sit down more and more and you know, interact with different specialities, it becomes clear that this versatility of thought is fundamental to driving these projects forward. So absolutely not. The bulk of students tend to be, you know, medical students and master's level students from the Faculty of Health Sciences. But, you know, we've got social services, we've got rehabilitation services. So there's no limit. I think, you know, a really diverse research group will be able to fit in somebody from anybody with a research interest will find a space in the neurosciences.
Now, what I can pick up now also is it networking skills that we need to collaborate with other industries, or would you also suggest some upskilling, that you don't just walk out with your own degree and you upskill yourself to stay relevant in your industry?
You know, that is a really nice way to phrase it. I would say that exposure, firstly, you know, and awareness. So exactly what you're doing here, creating awareness around a topic is so important, because oftentimes people, or at least students, have a one-track point, you know, where they have to complete what they started out with, and once that's done, you know, they want to go into a workforce or, you know, at least some sort of earning capacity. And that's difficult to change in our environment. And I'm very aware of the fact that there are constraints, both resource and financial, but collaborating, networking, stimulating these young, bright minds, I think is incredibly important, that people realize that this is not an end point. You know, it's a journey. And as soon as they realize how much one can enjoy the journey, that process changes, or the whole thought process changes. They don't see this as an exit point where, you know, they need to start and finish within a certain amount of time, but they can stay on for as long as possible. Obviously, this comes with funding. It comes with a broad sort of research network. But it would be great if we started to maneuver or panel beat the thought process for our students, where they start to see this as a growth process, you know, not just an endpoint.
I have to ask, how do you do it all? Because you are currently the head of Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Pretoria. You are the chief specialist and pediatric neurosurgeon at the Steve Biko Academic Hospital. You are an author, and you are doing a lot of publications, a lot of motivational speaking, and then you still review for international medical journals, as well as those executive roles on various international neurosurgery societies. Please tell me, where do you get the time, or how do you prioritize this?
So as I listen to you say that, I wonder myself, how does a person get the time to do those things? I suppose, you know, if you enjoy what you do, and I think this is an undervalued part of everyday mundane existence. If you find joy and purpose in what, and I'm saying you as in, you know, not myself specifically, if one can find that joy and purpose, then these things tend to become less of a task and more of a privilege. I said this earlier, and you know, I teach all my registrars that the privilege of being able to treat patients with conditions where families and parents will trust you with the care of their child. As I see it, there's no more difficult thing for a parent to do ever than to hand over the care of their child to some person you've never met before, you know, and all of a sudden they tell you numbers and terms that you've never heard before, and then within a very short period of time you've got to sign a consent form. So I think if we define that and it becomes very clear that this is a privilege, and you know, you train correctly, and the more you practice, the better you become at it, and the better you become, the more you enjoy it. I think that that cycle is one that we shouldn't leave any part out of. Make it clear that it's a privilege. Train people properly so they enjoy what they do, and the more they enjoy it, the better they become at it. I think that cycle is one that is self-sustaining.
Now, let's say what you have studied in neurosciences is not a job anymore. What else would you have liked to do?
At the moment, if you were to ask me what I would do if I wasn't a neurosurgeon, the answer to me is pretty clear. I would want to be a chef, because I feel it allows me to create things in a way that, you know, I can see the products of what I'm doing very tangibly, which is quite different to what I do on a daily basis.
Very
but it's quite
different.
Nice to put effort in something, follow a recipe and see an outcome, which is very different to, you know, a daily sort of grind in pediatric neurosurgery. So that would be my answer. I hope that makes sense.
Now, Prof, out there in the media, we are reading a lot about eat for your mind, sleep for your mind, exercise for your mind. What do you think are two things that we can do for brain health?
So I'm so glad you bring that point up. You know, I think for the longest time, even though there's been a passive acceptance that the brain is the core of the body, that the body is designed effectively as the carrier for the brain, the amount of emphasis that you pointed out now that is placed on the brain and optimizing its function. So there are a number of things, you know, balancing one's activity load, finding a place where you're able to actually rest, meditate, you know, get your brain to download the thoughts for the day and just reset yourself. So that balance, that psychological balance, really, I would say even emotional balance is incredibly important. As you said, exercising, eating for your mind, it's important to realize that focusing just on one area where you're just looking at putting information or knowledge into the brain, but not focusing on things like, you know, exercise and detoxing, because that is incredibly important. So I think the point that should be made here, just to sum that up, is it's not just a one-size-fits-all solution. One of our research projects, which is something I'm incredibly excited about, is assessing the brain-gut microbiome. So how the kind of microbiomics of the gut affects the brain, both in normality and in specific conditions. And that's incredibly exciting. And it probably sums up a lot of what you're saying now, that none of the systems in the body act in isolation. So the brain's health is fundamentally determined by the rest of the state of the body. So what you eat in terms of the microbiome, how much you exercise, also defines that. So it's a very interconnected system. And you need to remember that. Looking after the brain involves looking after the body as well. And a lot of the cognitive neurosciences suggest exactly that. The brain, you have to understand that it is interconnected to the body in so many different ways that you have to look after it, you know, in more than one specific avenue.
Thank you so much for that. Let's get into some easier questions, some quick questions. Coffee or tea?
So it depends, for me particularly, it depends where I am. If I'm on an aeroplane, it's always tea, because I learned on a Norwegian flight once that tea is such a vital antioxidant. So outside of that, I would say coffee, but on an aeroplane, tea.
All right. Sweet or salty?
I'm going to go with salty there for a very kind of clear bias. I'm just going to say salty, yeah.
Remote or on-site?
On-site.
Every morning I
try to convince myself that I should exercise and meditate on a consistent basis, but consistency is a problem. So every morning I try to convince myself that I should, but I don't always get to do it.
My favorite word is?
I suppose I would have to say kintsukuroi.
Excellent. Prof, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it, and all of the best with all this wonderful work that you are doing.
Okay, thank you so much.
That's it for now. Listen to all our episodes to make sure that you get into the fast lane of career success.